Hello everybody, and welcome to Mind Clickers. My name is Lachlan, and I'm a sport and exercise scientist from Melbourne, Victoria, Australia, with a passion for esports performance, coaching, and overall mental well-being. I've been in esports for quite my life, previously competing in COD 4 Pro Mod, and avidly rushing to 10th prestige in Modern Warfare 2. I also previously coached StarCraft 2 and avidly love CSGO and all current FPSs. I created MindClickers to provide an insight into the psychological and performance demands of elite level gaming. This includes getting an insight from coaches, athletes, staff, management, and also allied health professionals about esports. In the following episode, I talk with the amazing Josh Shinobi Abastado, as he provides a surreal insight into his previous coaching and also performance as an in-game leader coming off the Cloud9 Valorant team. Josh goes in depth as he touches on the importance of having confidence, effective communication, and also marketability. Josh also talks about the importance of establishing a positive team culture and flowing dynamic so that as a leader, everyone can go into the game with the same mindset and be ready for whatever happens. Thank you very much. And I know it's been a little wait, but I really appreciate it. And I really hope you take some really good points from this episode. Thank you very much, and I hope you enjoy. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to episode 2, season 2 of Mind Clickers, where it's time to click both heads in 2020. I'm joined here today by a very exciting guest, Josh Shinobi Abastado, who recently just came off the Cloud9 team for Valorant as an in-game leader, and has a lot of experience previously in esports as a whole. How are you going today, mate?
Doing all right, man. Taking it pretty easy, chilling out. How about yourself?
Yeah, nice, man. Same over here in Melbourne. Whereabouts were you based again?
I'm in Southern California in Los Angeles. So a bit of ways away from you.
Yeah, a little bit of a time difference, but you know, this has been in the making for a while, so I'm very excited to get you on today and have a big chat.
Yeah, likewise. What time is it over there, by the way, right now, local time?
It is currently 1:20 p.m.
Okay. On Friday, right?
Yeah, man, Friday afternoon. Yep. What time is it over there?
It's 6:20 here on Thursday in the evening.
So we're essentially just like a little bit of a time travel at the moment. Basically from the start, we'll just go through a couple of topics and I guess we'll just kick it off.
Sounds
with
good.
Your background in esports and competitive gaming and why you made that transition and when you made that transition from casual to competitive and what really spurred you to go towards that path.
Yeah, so like the first FPS that I played was actually, it was Counter-Strike Source. This was back in like 2005, 2004. I was like 10 years old, I think, 10, 11, something like that. I started getting into competitive gaming maybe in like 2006, 2007 with Call of Duty 2. I played in the Cal League back then, and then I finally got a good computer where I was able to like play a game on a decent PC, and I started playing Source again on ESEA. This was back in like 2009. I never really like had any desire or like idea like, oh, I really wanted to go pro in gaming, and like I like it was like kind of like a goal that I set, but I just kind of played for fun, and competing was just like what I found enjoyable. So it was like, you know, I enjoyed competing in that aspect, but it was never like a driving desire to want to become a pro like player by any means. It was like only in CSGO in like 2014, 2015, when I actually met my former teammate on C9, Vice, and we made a team together. And it was like that team, I kind of realized that like, hey, I'm like pretty good at this. And our team was pretty good. And we made the pro league like the first season after we put that team together, and so it just kind of happened by, I wouldn't say coincidence, but it was like, you know, it wasn't something where I was like super driven to want to become a pro, and it was like my sole goal in life, right? Like where I was gonna, like, you know, I was going to school when I made pro. I was, you know, full-time college student, and so I had like, obviously I had like plans that were priority, but then once I realized that like I can make a career out of this. That's kind of what changed my opinion, right? And then once I obviously got there, it was like, you know, I'm going to try to do this as long as I can, because most people don't get the opportunity to pursue something like this. So,
hell yeah, man, that's awesome. You know, I definitely think that you see it a lot nowadays, where it's hard to make that transition and to make that choice, whether you want to go into that fully adaptable esports scene, or else you want to stay back and, you know, maybe do a little part-time study. You know, when you made that decision, what was your thought process around it? Was it like, I really should commit to it, or, you know, maybe, I can do like a couple of subjects here and there, you know, try and do something part-time as well?
Yeah. So in hindsight, a lot of the time that I took off, I probably like didn't need to. I'd probably have my degree finished at this point if I didn't take the time off, because I was thinking like, oh, I'm not gonna, like, people always say like they get overwhelmed with like the amount of like hours they have to put into the game and practice and things like this. But when I look back at the time, it was like definitely manageable. Like there was a lot of time that I wasted where like I was just like, you know, screwing around and obviously enjoying my time, but I could have been still doing classes part-time. And I kind of regret that, because I would have my degree at this point, but I don't regret like obviously pursuing this and doing this, right? I think with C9, it was definitely like I didn't, with like this most recent team, I was definitely like I did not have the time to go to school. But like I think back to like my first professional team with Complexity back in like 2016, it was like we were not playing in like anything besides like the ESEA Pro League at that time. So it's like, I definitely had poor time management. I could have definitely taken advantage of the free time that I basically thought I wouldn't have. But I mean,
it's a hard decision to make, man. And, you know, ultimately what it comes down to is, yeah, you have those free gaps, but, you know, is it really something that you actually wanted to do during that time? And I mean, obviously where you are now, in hindsight, you could have had your, you know, extra degree, but I mean, ultimately you might not have ended up where you are now if you had have, you know, put a little bit more attention into focus into those studies. So I guess every, you know, every sword has its double edge, and I mean, you know, all props to where you've landed now, obviously. So back in 2016, when you were in Complexity, was that in CSGO?
Yeah, it was. It was in CSGO, correct. So I played with Complexity. That was my first salaried team that I played on. I was on that team for like 6-7 months, and then I went to United, and we were like the first team that they had, like ever. That was like they just made the org and formed it and signed us. We were like their first signing. Then I went from United to this team called Enigma 6. They're like a Call of Duty org. Did not really have that good of an experience with them, but I won't get into the details. Then from there I played on on Rogue with Hiko and Vice and a couple other players. Kadian is another person that was on that team. He's a Danish player in CSGO. And then from that team I actually transitioned into being a coach. I coached the team Dignitas for about a year. After that, I kind of just like took a hiatus from the pro scene. I just kind of played like the league below pro at that point. I was like ESEA Premier. I was playing that kind of just for fun, just casually. And then Valorant came out. I wouldn't necessarily say I played casually, but it was like I was trying to be a player again for a bit. And then it became increasingly more difficult to be like get an organization to represent your team and get like a salary and all these things, because it was, I mean, CS is dying in NA. Like it's, and at this point now with Valorant in 2020, like with COVID and everything, like it's pretty safe to say that NACS is like completely dead, but it was already dying off at that point. This was like late 2019. It was like, you know, really slowly dying off. And when Valorant came around, I instantly knew that I wanted to switch, because well, I wouldn't say I instantly knew. I thought about potentially switching, and when I played the game, it really like reinvigorated that like fire I had to compete. It's like something I had lost for a really long time, and so it just made sense for me to switch to Valorant and try to play. Now here we are.
All right, man. What a resume. What a background.
Yeah, better on the block.
So when you were back playing COD and then obviously going into Source, Was there ever the mindset of going down the COD route rather than the, you know, the Counter-Strike route? Obviously, they had the big boom from COD 4 Pro Mod.
So, honestly, no, because I played COD 2 mostly because I can't even remember how I got into playing playing competitively in COD. I just because one of my friends who was a lot older than me. He was like a family friend. He was like 15 when I was like 10, so he was like 5 years older than me. He actually showed me Source, and I remember I went to his house and I played Source for the first time on his computer, and I was like, this game is amazing. So I have to get this. So I went home and told my dad, like, I need to get a computer. My computer at home was, well, first I just said I need to get the game. So I got the game, and my computer at home was like so bad that I was getting like 15 FPS on like the lowest resolution. And so I ended up building a computer, and I bought COD 2 like at that point. And I remember I was just playing a pub, and somebody told me, like, they thought I was pretty good for like being really young and that I should like consider playing competitively. I didn't like know anything about it at that point. And I had played, that's when I like had joined a few teams in Cal, and I don't really remember like how I ended up like networking with these people, but I basically ended up just playing on some of the top teams in COD 2 at that time. And then there was actually a couple guys that I knew from COD that were playing at that same time. And they also played Source. And basically, like, I didn't know that Source was like a game that people were actually playing competitively, because I was like really young. And then once they told me that they were also playing Source, I was like, oh wow, like, I want to give that a go, because I really liked that game when I was like a kid. And I was still a kid at this point, but I ended up just playing with them in Source, and I loved CS so much that I basically stopped playing COD and I went full switch to back to CS. And also, I also dabbled in, I played Gears of War competitively on the Xbox 360. That was probably the only console game I really tried to play. But I was always like a PC gamer. I never really enjoyed consoles that much. So, COD was never really something I wanted to do, because after COD 2 and Pro Mod with COD 4, it basically all went to consoles. So it was never really something I was interested in. So for me, it was basically CS always.
Man, that really resonates with me awesomely, just because I have so many vivid memories of just kicking back, playing Gears of War, Snipers Only, or, you know, Halo, you know, all those kind of awesome games on the console. MW2, man, what a grind. Black Ops 1, all of them. And then really transitioning onto PC and entering into, like, you know, COD 4 Pro Mode. And that's where I guess I started to really learn strats and really started to get into that, you know, habit of doing strats, because I didn't play too much Source. But when Go came out, that was when I really started to turn up a little bit. But obviously, coming from that background in such a tight and game and within the FPS industries, you know, Source, a lot of pros really grew up playing Source. So, you know, transferring from, you know, that really streamlined gun gameplay in Counter-Strike into a Valorant, which is, you know, some could argue a lot more fast pace. And, you know, the biggest difference, of course, is that there's abilities. So how do you think, you know, coming from that background and then starting to learn those abilities, because obviously some Valorant players now previously got into it from Paladins or Overwatch, so they have those underlying ability mechanics. So did you find that transition difficult? What was, you know, how did you really approach that?
So I think at Valorant's core, like, surface, like, you know, face value on the surface, it shares a lot of similarities when it comes to like the fundamentals of the game of CS, like, you know, post plants and, you know, mid round decisions and all these things. But honestly, like, I've been playing Valorant now for like almost 10 months, right? At this point, 9-10 months. And I honestly don't even really try to compare the game to CS, because it is a lot different. Like, like I said, the core fundamentals are the same, like the things I mentioned, but the way you approach the game is just so different, because there's like ultimate orbs and different abilities. And, you know, there's like crazy damaging abilities that can be used. And like every gun is like really strong. Like, there's like in CS, you'd never be in a situation where like you get the bomb down in the 3v3 and then like somebody gets a kill on the other team. And then they have a fucking, excuse my language, but they have a, a rocket launcher or some crazy ability, right? That's just going to like completely change like the way that you're going to play out the round. And so, even though, like, fundamentally the game plays similarly, the way you think about situations, you have to be a lot more reactive and also more proactive at the same time, because like even holding bomb sites on like defense in Valorant compared to CS, like CS, everybody has the same kit, so it doesn't really matter who plays where, because theoretically everybody can do the same thing as long as you have the answer. Like, right. Any person can basically create the solution and do it, right? But in Valorant, like, you need something specific to handle certain situations. So that means you actually have to bring people to the spot. So there's a lot more like dynamic gameplay that occurs. And it also makes the game extremely difficult, because like if you're playing on the site as a Sova or something and you get bombarded by flashbangs, you don't really have a good way of dealing with it. So you have to play the game in a different way versus like having a duelist there, like a Arena or something, you know, it's going to completely change how you would play the round. So I think A lot of those things are why Valorant is, you know, really unique and fun, but it's, you know, it shares again the same kind of core elements from CS. And I also feel like Overwatch players and, you know, Paladins players, like you mentioned, these kind of guys, like they can be just as good at Valorant as CS players. I think at this point it's like the more the game is out, the better these players are gonna be, because like again, it's only surface that the elements are the same. Like, I don't even look at people as being like, oh, I want to play with that guy because he was really good in CS versus like, oh, that guy was, you know, not good.
Sure, man. I love the passion. It's just, it's such an interesting game when you compare it at its core fundamentals. You know, obviously that, you know, both teams, both players, each team needs those acute underlying key mechanics. You know, you need to be able to aim, you need to be able to have those core abilities to understand different scenarios. But what it comes down to, like you said before, you know, multiple scenarios leads obviously to multiple matchups, which then ultimately leads to different outcomes. And then, you know, from a strategy perspective, that's so diverse, and, you know, it just puts everything on like 4D chess almost. And like you said, you know, just having those pre-existing game knowledge and mechanics is crucial whenever entering any game, just because, you know, each game will have its own meta, each game will have its own different characteristics that make it unique. And that's why people are playing it. From a, you know, from a viewership perspective, do you think that having this such dynamic, you know, value to the game and having these abilities and mechanics increases the excitement from a viewership perspective? Because obviously, you know, we see different teams adapt different meta styles based on their champion pools, you know, different strategies start to come out. Is that just so much more exciting, do you think, for the players? I know it is for me.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the things that Riot have done, like, I'm not a big fan of some of the changes they did to the economy, like saving your gun, you get punished. And like, I think a lot of the choices that Riot have made, it's with the spectator in mind, which is good because that's going to grow the game. It definitely, there's some things I'm disappointed about as like a professional player, right? Like being a competitor, there's certain aspects of the game that I don't enjoy. Not to say I don't like the game or I don't think the game is great, because, you know, I play it every day. But like, I think Valorant is more engaging and exciting as a viewer, just because like the crazy abilities and things make every round super exciting, right? Like, I think about all the big matches that I've played in the tournaments with Cloud9, and like, to me, I mean, granted, I am the one playing in them, so they are more memorable in that regard, but like, even watching these big matches, like the TSM Sentinels finals, like 100 Thieves, like these finals to me are much more exciting and memorable to me than like a CS major that I watch, just because, like, one, the game matches are always really close and hectic because it's a faster paced game in the sense of like the rounds, right? Like, the actual duration of the matches is a lot shorter than CS. And also because of the abilities and ults, like, you get in these crazy situations, like these crazy rounds that just make the game really fun to watch. I can't say it's better than CS, because CS always have a place in my heart as a, you know, amazing game. It's just CS definitely is more it's stagnant. It's a stagnant game. It's very slow progression in terms of like how the meta shifts, and so Valorant's just like overall exciting, right? It's to be determined if it's going to be long lasting, right? Like, that's more on to Riot and how they choose to develop the game. But right now, I think it's definitely a more exciting game for the viewers and for the competitors, I think.
Yeah, you make some really good points. And, you know, I've asked this question before on my podcast, but I really am interested from your professional perspective. If Valorant today wasn't produced by Riot Games and it was produced by a smaller indie game company, you know, maybe coming out on Steam free to play, exact same game, you know, do you think it would still have the popularity that it does today? Would it still have the competitiveness? Would it still have the drive, the eager, the push? Would it still be as dominant in the esports FPS genre, you know, marketplace as it is today, do you think?
Honestly, probably not. And I say that only because I think, like, namespace has, like, a lot of power. Like, even whether or not that's good or bad, it's just, like, you look at Battalion, right? And granted, like, that game was, like, super poorly handled and it was mismanaged. But, like, people are less inclined to, like, want to get behind a game. Not because it's a bad game, necessarily. It's because, like, you know that, like, when a company like Riot is putting out a game, they're going to support it, and there's the money and the ecosystem in place that's going to make the game worth your while to play, right? Like, if you play an indie game, like, from an indie company, it's like, the game could be amazing, right? It could be super popular, and it's, like, a really good game, but it's not going to have the same scene and the same growth as, like, a game that's developed by a tier one developer, right? Like, a company as big as Riot, it doesn't even matter if the game is good or bad, it's going to be played because it has the money and the funding put into it, right? So, you know, third party organizers, like event organizers and all these things, like ESL and all these companies, like, they're gonna host tournaments because it's Riot involved, right? So I think that does play a big factor.
Yeah, I definitely agree. It was a similar response to what Ricey said. You know, having that external viewership, having those stockholders that are invested into the game, you know, having so much, you know, you could say pressure on the game to succeed just because of how much backing it has. It does definitely dictate and stimulate the economy of the game and how well it will perform, obviously. You know, and they can afford to have big tournaments, big majors, and, you know, it's ultimately good for the game. Now, I absolutely love this question just because I ask a lot of people why they do, you know, what they do and, you know, the reasons behind it. You know, obviously with Valorant, there's such a diverse roster role. You know, no two champions, maybe a couple are similar. How did you go about choosing your main when the game first came out? Was it just a matter of, you know, experiencing, you know, all the different champions? You know, how did you go about selecting who was the right fit for you?
So I've never had, like, a dead set main where I was like, I played the same agent from day one to the end. Like, especially with C9, like, I ended up being an Omen main at the end. Like, I was basically almost basically a one trick Omen, because nobody plays Brimstone at the high level in NA.
right.
But I started off playing. I mean, I tried everything, right? Just for the team. Like, I played Duelist for a little bit. I never really thought that I'd play a Duelist in the team, just because, like, there's other players that I think that would be more comfortable playing on a Duelist. But I tried playing Sentinels. I played Sova for a while in the tournaments. I played Breach a bit, but we ended up kind of just realizing or figuring out that, like, Omen was, like, a comfortable role for me to play for the team. And it was, like, not so much that I felt, like, super comfortable on Omen on my own. I definitely like the agent, and he's fun to play, but moving people off of Omen and putting people in more comfortable positions for themselves, it made more sense for the context of the team. But I personally would really like to play a Sentinel on the next team I play for. Mm-hmm. I think it's a play style that I enjoy, because I was always kind of more of, like, a lurker. And I think I'm really creative and I have, like, a good mind for the game. And so I think playing a Sentinel suits my skill set a lot more, even though I didn't play one on C9. But that's something that I would like to do, moving forward.
Oh, all right. That'll be interesting to see in the future. Yeah, I'm definitely keen to to see some big frags coming out then. So in regards to obviously having that character pool, like I said previously, and, you know, being able to not really have a definitive main, does that mean, you know, within the team you were required to maybe have a few champions that you could accessibly use in case of a counter pick, for example?
So, yeah, that's actually an interesting topic, because right now you actually don't see, like, very much counter pick, if any counter pick, because like, the system is, like, you know, it's not like a pick phase. It's just kind of like you blind pick, and then when people pick their agents, you know, you go into the match, and then everyone's agents are revealed, right? Exactly. So you kind of most of the preparation is going to come down to like, oh, we know that this team plays this comp on this map, and then, you know, we kind of have like a game plan for it. I guess theoretically in that port, in like in that moment, you could decide to do a counter pick, but it's more random, right? It's more blind. It's not like in like League of Legends or in Dota where like you would, you know, have a pick phase and then you see like, oh, they picked, you know, Storm Spirit mid, like we're going to counter pick him and pick something else, right? Versus, especially with no bans, like it has like a, it's not a very good dynamic, but I think in the future, the like when there's more agents and I think people are more comfortable and like strategies are way more fleshed out for teams, because I still think a lot of teams are very static. Like most tactics that people employ in the game right now, it's meta to meta. So when the meta changes, people bring out new tactics, right? Or like in between like major tournaments, they might add new strats, but people don't have like a super deep playbook where they're playing like 2-3 different comps on a map and they have like a ton of strategies and things, because people are not like super well versed even right now at like having a deep agent pool. Most people are only specialists on like one or two agents. So right now that's not really a thing, but I think down the line it will be a big part of the game. Or I hope, at least, because I think it will make it more exciting and more interesting.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess, you know, one of the biggest things obviously is that it's backed by Riot, and you know, they have pre-existing knowledge on how to implement a pick and ban phase. So, you know, by incorporating one of these phases, how much of a psychological difference do you think it will make going into a big game?
I think it would be very interesting, because right now, like, almost every team, they rely on agents like Sova, right? Like, every team runs a Sova at the top level. Like, there's only a couple teams. Like, C9, funnily enough, we were, like, one of the only teams that didn't play Sova, and we were still a top three, top five team for most of the year. But, yeah, like, adding agent bans, it would remove, like you would no longer have these, like, must-have agents, like, in every comp. You would either see them 100% banned, which then they'd have to do something. They'd have to, like, either like buff other agents, so maybe you stop banning Sova, right? Like, because I would imagine right now if there was a banning phase, every team would ban Sova. Like, there would be no Sova being played. I think when they add more agents, I think it would be cool, because I think it will add this dynamic where like you can't just rely on one play style, right? You have to be ever evolving and really dynamic with your play, and I think that'll produce the best teams, in my opinion. You know, you can argue that, like, you know, teams are, you know, there's definitely obviously like a hierarchy of teams, but to be a top team consistently in a system like that, that's way more impressive, I think, than, you know, not to take away from any teams, it's still obviously impressive to be a top team that in any stage of the game, but yeah, that's kind of how I feel about it right now, at least.
Yeah, for sure. Because, you know, as soon as you remove a character, you're removing the fundamental strategy that you're going into the game with.
Exactly.
And obviously, more dynamic versatility means different strategy. And ultimately, that means a test of time to see how well each teams can adapt and overcome to being able to pick and ban.
Yeah, no, exactly.
So for those listening, you know, obviously for yourself being an in-game leader and IGL for, you know, previously the Cloud9 Valorant team, can you just give us some idea of what an IGL does? You know, some of the key characteristics that make a really great one.
Yeah, so my job as the in-game leader, obviously I'm calling the strategies and I'm setting up the game plan for the team, but I'm also, to be a good in-game leader, you also have to be an enabler for your teammates. Like, you want to, the way I try to design my teams is like, I don't really think, and it was like this in CS as well for me, I was never an in-game leader where like I have a strategy or a way I want to play the game and I just like put my players in those positions. I try to make my game plan around my players and their strengths, right? So I don't just like carbon copy a setup or a strategy and just like plug and play players. I really try to make my game plan around my personnel, and the main thing is just, you know, again, being an enabler for your teammates, you know, calling the strategies and leading the team in and out of the game, right? You want to be like a good figure for the team, right? You want to be a positive influence on them. But also, again, just enabling them and making sure that they're set up for success, because, you know, that's kind of what the job of the in-game leader is in my mind. Because, you know, there's strat callers, like there's a bunch of people that can be strat callers, but there's very few people that can be in-game leaders. And I think that people like the lines are usually blurred. People just kind of like clump those together. But to me, there's a big difference between a strat caller and an in-game leader.
Yeah, for sure, man. So in hindsight, being an in-game leader is, you know, being that voice of reason, you know, ensuring that teammates are communicating efficiently, you know, and effectively.
Yep.
You know, calling your enemies when they see them, and you know, ultimately it's your role to bring that diverse strategy, that unique strategy, to the game plan on game day.
Yeah, no, it's pretty much.
Shout out to Big Ricey from OCE for that one. So when was it that it first clicked? You know, you first put the key in the door and turned it over and opened it. You saw yourself standing there in the glimmering light as an IGL for the team. When was it that you first had that mindset that, hey, you know, this is maybe something I could be interested in doing? You know, previously I was doing some stuff in CSGO, was it? Or was it more so, you know, I really want to, you know, this is something I really want to challenge and step up to this role and try and do?
So in CS, unlike a lot of people that become in-game leaders, I actually never had like a mentor. Like, I never had an in-game leader that I learned from or played under that like taught me kind of how to be a caller, right? Then I never learned from anybody. So when I was a up-and-comer, like back in 2014, 2015, I was honestly like just kind of like, people have this like, it's ironic because now people think the exact opposite of me. Like, people thought I was just like some brain-dead aimer, where like all I could do is run around and shoot, and I played like really ratty, and people just thought I was like, again, just like some idiot that just like all I could do is aim, and I pissed a lot of people off. And then just kind of over time, like, not, it's not an ego thing, but I'm definitely like the kind of person where I think that I'm confident in how I view the game or how I'm reading the game, and so I naturally just became the in-game leader because I didn't have anybody on any team I played on that, like, really, in my opinion, like, did the job like how I thought it should be done, right? I never had like a great in-game leader to play under, so I basically just took it upon myself, like, embraced the role, like, shit, if nobody's gonna do it, then I'm gonna be the guy to do it. I'm gonna try to do it better than anybody else. And just kind of over time, I've learned a lot through being an in-game leader, because like, I, not to say I was like a selfish player back then, but I definitely was like, played more for myself. And then as I got older and, you know, I see all these like really talented players, I just kind of have become more of just like a support player and, you know, again, this like enabler type of mentality, you know, help my team. Cause I know that like my job as the caller is like, I'm trying to, you know, lead the team in the best way I can. And so, you know, I want to enable my star players and things like this, but long-winded way of answering your question, but.
No, good, man. I love that. It's an absolutely brilliant story. You know, it's kind of like the underdog story. Who would have known? Big Shinobes, you know, back in the CSGO days, you know, bang, he's into Valorant, bang, bring the energy, bring the pace, you know, bring the strats, bring the comms. And it shows, you know, it obviously shows now through your experience and through your, you know, the ability to, you know, develop yourself and understand that there was an area that you could slot into and bring that background knowledge and, you know, work on it as well. So I commend you for that, man. It's awesome. Now, another thing I'm dying to know as well, I have a pretty good idea how everything happens down in OCE for the region of, you know, finding a scrim, for example. How does everything work in NA? Is it, you know, you guys as players go out and message other players, you know, try and organize a scrim? Is that predominantly done through the coaches? Is that done through some other guys in the squad, in the team? How does everything work in, you know, in regards to organizing a friendly practice scrim against game, just to try and get to, you know, work some strategies, test some strats out?
Yeah, so, I mean, practice is usually, we have a Discord where, you know, all the top teams play against each other and book practices. When I was on C9, they wanted us to do in-house practices with like the female team, the C9 white team. We never did. I don't know if they are now, but yeah, I mean, most of the practices are going to be just against the other teams in the region. I can't say to like other teams if they do like in-house drills, like if they drive, like how much dry running practice, like strategies, or if they do anything like I have no idea, right, what teams do. I can only speak for like when I was on C9, and we did like dry running for strategies, but we never like did like in-house drills or things like this. It was almost entirely just, you know, theory, dry running and the server, like server work, and then scrims just like against other teams. And our practice schedule was like 5-6 days a week, and we'd play like 3 or 4 maps a day. plus like an hour or two of discussion in theory. So it was like a 6-7 hour day in total.
Ooh, I like that. Yeah, I like that little bit of theory on the end. It helps to wrap up the day. That's kind of cool. I like that. I like. I think definitely all teams should do that. I've spoke with a couple of guys in the past prior to my podcast, and they kind of just, you know, that was training. Now they go ahead and do their own thing. But definitely have, you know, like a 10-15 minute wrap up at the end of a session just to kind of go over and kind of make sure everyone's on board with everything. That's definitely critical, and I can definitely see that being an advantage in regards to, you know, coaching and all that kinds of things as well. And that leads me to, you know, another point I'm super interested in. In terms of analysis, you know, how does everything work? Is it like a, you know, one-on-one with the coach? Do you sit down as a squad, you know, after a big game, after a big tournament? Do you, you know, go through and reflect together, or is it more by, you know, do you prefer to go through it, you know, by yourself? Take us through that.
A little bit of all of it, to be honest. Most of the time after a match, we would watch the game back together as a team. And then if there was something specific we wanted to work on, or the coach wanted to like help somebody with a specific problem that he saw, then he would obviously like talk to them one-on-one if it was necessary. But like the team culture on C9, we were pretty open. Like everybody would be pretty open to criticism. And so we usually just had like open format discussions about our matches. And then for preparation, most of the preparation, like sometimes we would watch our opponent together, but most of the preparation came down to me and our coach when it came to the game planning for the match beforehand, right? And then afterwards we'd have the more group, full team kind of discussions.
Yeah, I really love that multiple case scenario of being able to have a one-on-one with a coach, or being able to step aside and, you know, talk with a couple of teammates, go over a few plays, go over through strats. And I think that all comes down to, again, like you said, having an efficient team culture. I think it's one of the most pivotal 100%. Things you can do to ensure that there is a consistency throughout the team, and that everyone's on board, not only physically but mentally as well, to ensure that we're all on the same level going into a game, post-game. We're having those good positive vibes that can ensure longevity for the team as well.
I agree entirely. I think something that a lot of people overlook is, like, you know, people always see, like, we're super talented and great rosters, right? And even in like traditional sports, right? You see like a ton of like amazing players put together on a team, and you know, it does. People wonder like, how is it not working in the team? And I think people really undervalue and overlook the importance of like team culture and having people, right? It's really hard to get five people on the same page in game. It's even harder, I think, to get everybody on the same page out of game as well. And that's like something that people don't really take into account, right? A lot of times people are fixated on what happens in the game, and they don't realize that like things out of the game can be a huge influence on like why people are playing the way they are, or, you know, like why things are you know, going the way that they are as well, you know. So
yeah, for sure. And I think another big characteristic of it is, of course, you know, that personality. You know, when you go to a LAN or a tournament, you know, you can see the personality of a team when they celebrate, for example, you know, where they pull off a 1v3 or a 1v4, or take the map, take the round, whatever it may be, the way they celebrate, and that kind of underpins what type of team culture they're trying to represent. You know, you have those teams that are really aggressive. You have those kind of teams that are really just laid back. Okay, we took it. Let's move on to the next. Let's stay focused. We got a job to do. So I think that's really interesting, exciting to see the different, you know, characteristic differences. You know, it's something small, but it's still there. Now, in regards to NA and EU, obviously, you know, when we think of esports, these are the regions that are predominantly booming. Here in OCE, progression is alive, but it's a little bit slow, but we are getting there eventually. You know, what is NA trying to do to actively become the esports capital, do you think?
I mean, honestly, I just think that a lot of the orgs are based here, and so naturally they want to have teams close to home, right? Like, I don't think Oceania, like, they lack talent or good players. It's just that the orgs are, that's, you know, there's just not a big ecosystem there for orgs, right? Like, there's a few organizations that are there in Australia and things like that, but I think the biggest difference is just because there's more support. I'd also say there's a bigger player base here in NA. It's a bigger, you know, there's more population and things like that, but I think it ultimately just comes down to the orgs are here, so the investment's going to be at home, right? If there was a really good Oceanic team, I'm sure that there'd be an org that'd be interested in picking them up, but especially right now with COVID and everything, like, I mean, if you look at CS, like, 100 Thieves, they let their CSGO team go because it was difficult to house them and everything, and, like, you know, support them in the way that they needed to be supported, because they were, you know, the Australian team living in LA, and, you know, it's difficult right now. But yeah, I don't think it has anything to do with the player base. I think it just has to do with the, you know, the coincidence and the, you know, just the investment that's in the scenes, right? I think that's, like, how it comes down. The more opportunities that there are, the more likely you're going to get the best talent to be playing, right? Because the opportunities are just there.
Yeah, for sure. Those big teams who can really come in and have that kind of resources to play around and really establish their maximum value within the region. And I think that really, you know, incorporates external support as well. You know, do you think that there is a really pivotal role for, you know, performance coaches, physiotherapists, nutritionalists, even, you know, sports psychologists, those type of, you know, external allied health professionals to come in and assist with players on that one-on-one mental well-being level, but also physically as well?
So I know the big tier one orgs definitely do. Like C9, we had a sports psychologist. I know 100 Thieves have a sports psychologist. I'm pretty sure, like, if everybody was living at the team house, I believe that they have, like, people that, you know, they have a chef and they have, like, people that deal with, like, mental health, physical health, right? Like, trainer, these, like, physical trainer, things like this. Yeah, for us, at least in the time, we had just a sports psychologist who I talked to a few times. But I don't really think that the lower tier orgs have access to those resources. It's mostly going to be your elite tier one orgs, like your C9s, your Liquids, your 100 Thieves, like things like that. But I think down the line, I think every big org will have, I'm sure most of them have this already, but every big org should have these things. And I think the only thing that prevents, you know, the orgs from making use of them and getting good advantages, the players, I think, are sometimes reluctant to want to talk to sports psychologists. Like, people kind of, like, gamers are weird, man. Like, they're like, it's really stubborn. A lot of gamers are really stubborn. Like, they don't want to talk to a sports psychologist because there's, like, this weird, like, stigma, like, I don't know, like, you know, I don't know how to explain it. It's just kind of like people don't want to get help because they just think that, like, what they're going to tell them is stuff they already know, but, like, people are already, like, not open-minded to the idea, so, like, they're not going to get the benefit out of it, and that's, you know, it's a loss for them, unfortunately.
Yeah, for sure. I definitely agree, and I think that step one is just having that baseline availability. You know, obviously, you know, a lot of teams don't have the resources, and I think, you know, over in here in Perth in Australia, there's a couple of, you know, psychologists who do clinical work, but also do some volunteer work with some esports teams, and, you know, that's more just along the lines of case management, stress management, you know, going to a big competition, you know, ensuring that the players are feeling well and having a really good positive quality of life. But again, I think one of the biggest things is being able to have the availability. I think that's step one, just being able to have that access. You know, if you want to talk to them, yeah, no worries. If you don't, hey, that's okay. I think, you know, as esports gets bigger, and obviously we've seen exponential growth within the last couple of years, these professionals will come in and play more of a pivotal role, especially when, you know, younger generations really start to step into esports as well, because obviously we have so much more younger pros now. And, you know, being able to adapt so early on and take on the pressure of these big, you know, tournaments and whatever, it's going to come with, you know, the side effects and, you know, being able to have that support, you know, even just, you know, have a chat with someone. I think it's definitely pivotal.
Yep, exactly. And yeah, I mean, like for us, like on C9, it was never mandatory that people had to talk to a sports psychologist. It was kind of like if you wanted to. And I'm pretty sure none of my teammates utilized it except for me. I mean, I'm not saying they have to, right? Like, if you know, it's at the end of the day, it's everyone's own decision that they want to make. But I personally felt that the sports psychologist was beneficial. And, you know, if it's a resource that's free and available to you, I feel like there's no reason not to take advantage of it. But to each their own.
Yeah, fair play, man, fair play. And I guess another kind of, you know, subcategory that is sports science. You know, obviously in traditional sports, it's pretty much a dominating factor, key category. You know, there's that constant need for performance measurement, constant understanding to see if athletes are getting faster, stronger, better, for example. But in esports, you know, we don't really have that underlying system to really track that. I know there is some things in the works over in UK, which is really exciting. But in regards to sports science measurement, you know, what's your thoughts on, you know, starting to maybe get an understanding for eye tracking, you know, eye movement, you know, where we're looking during, you know, different situations. Mm-hmm. I know there was a couple of research papers that looked at breathing, you know, holding our breath in different situations, and also heart rate, you know, comparing heart rate pre-game to post-game and, you know, seeing how we can adapt and seeing fluctuations in that, and that obviously leading to performance outcomes down the track.
I think for sure down the line. I mean, like, for – I don't know of any big – I'm trying to think. I don't know if any big tournament has really used, like, eye tracking or heart rate, like, monitors or things like this. But I know, like, some streamers, they definitely have, like, the eye tracking technology, and they'll use it on their stream sometimes. But I think it would be, like, a cool metric to have, like, maybe down the line when, you know, LAN events are coming back after COVID and everything. You might see this down the line. But, yeah, it's definitely interesting. I don't think a lot of – like, at least for, like, teams, like – like, even, like I said, you know, the, like, C9 and everything, they have, like, sports psychologists and things like this, but they don't actually have, to my knowledge, people that do these things where they track, you know, eye tracking, heart rate, things like this. That would be really interesting to see, you know, how it affects, or, you know, the results, right, from player to player. But it's weird, 'cause, like, sorry, like, when I think about it, too, like, I can't even tell you, like, how I react, like, in a situation. Like, I can't even tell you a definitive, like, oh yeah, like, I hold my breath, or I'm, you know, my heart, like, obviously, like, for me, I have so much experience playing matches in the tier one level at this point. Like, I've been competing professionally for like 5 years. I don't really get nerves or anything when I play, but there definitely are moments when the adrenaline is pumping and, right, you can feel your heart rate definitely raising. But it's weird, like, even though I know that those things are occurring, I'm not, like, tangibly feeling the pressure of it, because I'm so, like, kind of conditioned to play in these high pressure moments. But yeah, I still think it would definitely be really interesting to see those analytics.
Yeah, right. Well, and you know, one way to look at it is, you know, you've adapted, you know, you've adapted to, you know, going into your entry level source, and then, you know, experiencing, you know, COD 2, and then, you know, CSGO, you know, you can bring those previous experiences and how you performed and how you managed your stress into Valorant, and you know, that molds your understanding of how to perform in those high pressure situations. So that's fantastic. You know, and when we look at traditional sports specifically, a lot of athletes, you know, have a warm up, you know, even in esports. I've talked to a couple of guys who have, you know, they have to have their keyboards right. You know, and it might be something like wearing a favorite shirt or having a favorite meal before the game. Is there anything that's symbolic to yourself?
I don't really have a ritual. I just like to make sure that my hands are warm, and mentally I try to wake up and perform a match, like, at least have energy, have food. Yeah, I don't have, like, a, you know, some people have, like, weird rituals, like, they'll, like, put their shoes a certain way, or the, yeah, like you said, with their keyboard. But for me, I just try to make sure my hands are warm and I'm comfortable. That's, like, the main thing. Like, I don't like wearing jeans or anything if I'm playing regardless, but for matches, I definitely just want to be, like, wearing, like, loose fitting clothes and just, keep my hands nice and warm. That's, like, that's it for me.
Yeah, right. And is that the same with aim training, for example? You know, is that something you really need to try, you know, take at least, you know, 10 or 15 minutes to really, you know, in the range, for example, you know, get in the groove of really getting your mouse on point? Or is that something you do at home before you come, so you've really fleshed it out and, you know, you're really feeling pretty good and fresh?
So I like to do a warm-up scrim. So for, like, us, a lot of teams say that they're really slow starters, and that was definitely the case for us on C9. But I don't think it was necessarily, like, because of our mechanics. I think a warm-up scrim is the best because it gets you in the mind state of playing a match, right? Like, you want to get mentally into the, you know, you want to be in the state of mind of, like, I'm playing a match, and, like, this is, like, something that matters. It's important, right? And the communication is super important in a team-based game, like in any team, like any team thing. Mm-hmm. Communication is super, super valuable and important. And I think warming up your mechanics is good, but it's equally as important to warm up your communication. And the only way to do that really is through scrimming. But if scrimming is not an option, like, you know, we had a 10 a.m. match a few times, and, you know, it's hard to get a scrim at 9 a.m. to warm up for the game. So at that point, you just have to make the best of it and, you know, just warm up your mechanical aim and hope for the best. But
yeah, for sure. And you know, being that in-game leader, that voice of reason, the key communicator for your team, do you also bring the motivation? You know, is it one of those things where everyone's already hyped up, we already know what we're going to do, or you know, sometimes some of the guys need a little bit of a push up really to get in the spirit?
Definitely a bit of both, right? Like, you want to be a motivator. I was definitely a hype guy on the team. Like, people would have big rounds. You know, I'm the first guy to, you know, to hype somebody up or prop them up and make them feel good, even if they're having a bad performance. That's just kind of like my personality. But it's also important to stay focused, right? So, like, even though I'm getting hype and I'm, you know, shouting and, you know, I'm into the game, I'm also the guy who's like quickly able to get people focused and not have people be too excited, right? Because even if I show my excitement, I'm always focused on the matter at hand and winning the game, and I don't let my emotions, I won't say all the time, there's definitely instances where it occurs, but I try to keep my emotions in check and be you know, super focused on the win and, you know, doing my job.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess, you know, when some of the guys are like, you know, pulls off a 1v3, there's so much enthusiasm in the team, the motivation's there. But then being able to dial it back a bit and, you know, let's realign, for example, because you don't want to become too over-aroused, because when we become over-aroused, that's when we start to make those pivotal mistakes and we start to, you know, become off balance and, you know, making sure that we are dialed in, we know what we're doing, and being able to really have that good mindset at the start of each round to ensure performance.
Yeah, I mean, you'll definitely see that with less experienced teams, that they get, like, there's so many times you'll see a team that is like the underdog and they're up and they're winning, and then they lose the game, not because they're like bad or by any means, right? But it's because like they get over eager, right? Like they feel like they won the game already, and they make decisions that like they wouldn't make if they were playing against like a team that they felt is worse than them. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
that's kind of why the overdog has the advantage, because like, you know, a lot of times the underdog, even if they're like capable of winning the game, they lose the game because of mental reasons, right? They make like uncharacteristic mistakes, or they do like weird, you know, they make weird plays, and you know, they feel like the game is over before it's actually over. And that also goes to even teams that are like top teams that are inexperienced, they have trouble closing out games because they start to get cocky, and you know, they feel like the game is over before it's actually over. So I think that play a big part in a lot of teams. So you have to have that good balance, right? Like, you don't want to be one of those teams that's like, when the highs are super high and the lows are super low. Like, you want to be able to be kind of in the middle, right? Like, you know, you want to have highs, obviously, and feel good and, you know, have excitement and energy, but you also don't want to be solely predicated on emotions, because then a lot of the time you're losing the game based on emotional factors versus tangible in-game factors, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, just being able to have that stabilization to control the emotion and, you know, ultimately stay positive during those circumstances, that's when it's critical to stay calm for performance. Now, I got to ask this question. Obviously, you know, coming off the C9 roster and having such elite performance history, you know, on the resume, what is your opinion on, you know, external programs like Kovacs, for example, different AIM traders, AIM Labs even? You know, obviously, you know, these programs are designed to really break down the nitty-gritty of your AIM, you know, whether it be tracking, reaction speed, you know, flicking, and being able to really, you know, work on those different type of, like, you know, broken down characteristics of your AIM. So do you use those personally? Do you know some of the lads who do? I think it's one of those things that's really praised as being there and, you know, really pivotal for performance. But then again, some guys just naturally are gifted with impeccable aim, like I'm sure I'd click into one taps, but yeah.
So I have used them. For me personally, like, I'm not too crazy about them. Like, I don't find them to be like obviously I think they're beneficial, but I'm not sold on them as like, oh my God, like I feel like you could train your aim in a lot of different ways. I don't think like you have to use Kovacs or Aim Labs to get a good warm up in. But you know, if people like to use them, then you know, to each their own. Like, you know, I think there's definitely merit in using them. For me, it's only, I find the value is like to warm my wrist up and get me like, you know, just aiming at stuff, right? Flicking around and just kind of warming up my hands. I don't really think it improves my aim that much, to be honest. But I think just playing the game, for me, playing the game a lot is like the easiest way to improve, like over AIM Labs and things like that. But
yeah, for sure. I definitely agree with that. And, you know, I know a couple of players who religiously do it. You know, I myself used to be one who really used to strive on AIM Labs and, you know, prior to a game, you used to have to religiously spend 10, 15 minutes in there just before going to a game, just so I can, you know, get that kind of mentally feel ready before a game. And I know, you know, ultimately it is each to their own. I've definitely strayed away from it a little bit just because I much prefer to, you know, get in the game and actually experience it in the game. Because obviously there's little things that are different, you know, maybe sensitivity, you know, the game mechanics, the game feeling, the graphics. Everything can, you know, be a bit different. But I think the biggest problem lies when people have more time in these external programs than in the game. That's when they become a bit more reliant on them and they don't actually, you know, start to perform as well as they thought they might. And they really start to focus on the AIM trainer rather than actually playing the game. You know, so I think it is, you know, a fine line, but I think each their own ultimately. Now, having, you know, so much previous experience back in the CSGO and, you know, doing your coaching, you know, obviously early days Valorant as well, you've developed this, I'm sure you've developed this really good confidence, you know, to go into a game with a positive mindset, best of three, you know what's on the line, you take it home or you go home with your tail behind your legs maybe. So do you think having confidence is pivotal for that high-end elite level performance?
Yeah, I definitely think you need confidence. I think, like, part of it obviously is you have to have ability. So, like, you know, you need to be fundamentally and mechanically a good team. But I also think that confidence is a huge part of, like, why teams are successful. Like, obviously they're skilled, but if you're feeling really confident, and confidence comes from, like, two things, right? Obviously there's, like, internal confidence, just, like, knowing and believing in your ability as a player. But the other kind of confidence that gets built is from having a game plan that you know, right? Like if everybody on the team is on the same page and you kind of know like what you're going to be doing, what everybody else on your team is doing, it means that you can be confident in your teammates to do their job and also be confident in knowing that, like, you know, everything I need to do, I know, right? I'm aware of, like, what I'm going to do, or you're aware of what the other team is going to be doing, right? So that also, like, exudes confidence and builds confidence in players. And so, you know, if you are confident, then you have a better chance of winning the game. Obviously, you still have to perform, and, you know, at the end of the day, it's a shooting game, so you have to still shots and do the right things in the game to win. But I think confidence is a huge part, and you see this all the time, man. There's, like, really good players that end up really underperforming on teams, and people just, like, point to them and, like, oh, they're underperforming, and, like, they're just not good, even though, like, you'll see it a lot where, like, those players will go to a new team and, like, they'll reinvigorate themselves and they'll become, like, better than they were before. And it's not because they were ever bad. It's just because of, like, factors that people can't see on the surface, right? Like, they build up their confidence, or their confidence gets shot and they never become the same player because they can't get the confidence back, right? Like, it's a very – gaming is a mental – it's obviously there's mechanics, right? But it's a big mental factor as well that people never really take for account. I mean, you can't really – like, because you never know, right? People don't know the behind-the-scenes stuff, so you can't really account for it. But it's just – it is a factor that's really vital and important. And you know, it's a shame because it does affect a lot of players. And a lot of players are really good, too.
Yeah, well, you know, between 40 and 90% of success is due to, you know, those psychological factors. And especially amongst the elite, around 90% because, you know, you already have those underlying fundamental, you know, physical skills. You know how to aim. You know where to position yourself. You know mentally, okay, I should be doing this. But it's those different mental edge skills that give you the edge between your opponents. And, you know, imagery, for example, in traditional sports, a lot of athletes like to imagine a positive outcome prior to a game. You know, they might imagine the crowd size. They might imagine how soft the ground feels when they're running on it, running out onto the stage, onto the field. Is imagery one of those techniques that you might incorporate into your routine? You know, imagining the crowd size, imagining going on, walking on stage, imagining your computer, imagining being in the booth, you know, all five guys, you know, we're ready to go, ready to rock and roll.
Honestly, not really. I've never actually thought about that. I don't know. It's never really been a thing I've thought about. Like, I think, I guess something that I would say that I've tried to emphasize to my teammates when it comes to like our communication. It's not really like the same kind of imagery that you're talking about, but like I tell my teammates that we want to strive for our communication to be so concise that like you can paint the picture for your teammates, right? So if there was no radar on anyone's screen, our comms are so good that you can literally visualize where everybody is on the map, right? And you can see the map. So in that regard, that is the kind of imagery that I think about and like try to envision, but that's more of like a team culture type of thing, right? And like a tangible communication. Awesome. It's not so much like an abstract concept of like, you know, like you said, visualizing the crowd or visualizing like, you know, your setup and things like that. But it's actually, yeah, it's really interesting to point out.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess another aspect of it is, you know, communication, being able to effectively calm, you know, an enemy when we see them, being able to effectively speak just to, you know, each other when under those stressful situations. Is that something you think that has been tentatively, you know, grown through repetition?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, the only way to really, it's communication is such a weird thing in gaming because like, I've never been somebody that struggled with communicating. Obviously, I'm an in-game leader, and so my communication is always going to be like a big part of my game. But, you know, everyone's born with the ability to, like, I mean, not everybody, but anyone who's playing a game competitively, for the most part, they're born with the ability to communicate. And it's very weird that there's, like, players that, like, they're incapable of communicating, but you can have, like, conversations with them. You know what I mean? It's like, communicating is something that like it's not a skill that you really have to develop in the sense of like you're born like to aim and things like this. You're not just born with like the ability to like aim, you know what I mean? Like it's something you can train and you have to like build over time, but like communication, as soon as you learn how to speak, like it's like inherently it's hard to explain. It's just kind of like, you know, some people don't have good communication and it's very difficult to train them to have better comms. And like the only way you really do it is either like power of will, like they have to willingly, like they have to be open and under and like basically accept the fact that hey, my communication is not good and like I understand like why or where my communication lacks and so I want to actively try to improve it, or they have to, you know, it just comes through repetition and seeing other people communicating well, so then you kind of have a model example of like, oh hey, that's what good communication looks like, I'm going to strive for my comms to be like that. But a lot of players are super fucking talented. They're really insane, but they have really poor communication. And so many people don't understand like, oh, why is this guy not on a top team? Like, this guy's so skilled. But then, like, what they don't realize is, like, if this guy doesn't communicate, he's mute, he doesn't bring anything besides aim, there's so many people that can aim and get kills and be really talented in that regard that, like, your communication is something that's going to separate you from the rest. So, like, you know, at the top level, you need to be the complete package if you want to be like one of the best players, because like there's always going to be some cracked 17-year-old kid that can headshot. So really, it's like the communication is something that's like so important, and it's something that everybody can do, but so many players like don't. It's very perplexing, but
yeah, gotcha. And I know if I think about my friend circle, there's one individual who, you know, he'll know who he is, who just calls things that are completely wrong. Like he might call for an A push when it's literally just one dude. All of a sudden, 5 seconds later, there's four guys jumping out on B. It's like, you know, being able to have those really good effective communication skills that are precise. I think precision is key. Being able to portray what you are seeing, you know, creating that visual pattern in as many words, you know, in as few words as you can, and being able to really withhold yourself from really clogging the comms. You know, is that something you've tended to see? You know, is there times where you've maybe had to withhold comms? Are some of the guys, you know, how does that kind of build over time?
Yeah, so I think a lot of it is going to come down to like, you know, the clearer the comms are. So like if people are feeding good information, it's going to be easier to know what needs to be said. You know what I mean? Like if people are just calming like nonsense and there's just like a lot of, it's super hectic, it can get lost. You know, like the comms can get lost and buried. But at the highest level, I've always been under the impression if like, if you think anything, like you see anything and you think it could be valuable, that you say it. Like you don't, like obviously like useless things like, oh, like, you know, I'm reloading, I have 25 bullets. Like things like this don't need to be said. Anything that you think is pertinent, because like the way you have to look at it is like everybody has their own set of eyes, right? You can't see what someone else is. So the only way for people to put the, again, paint the picture for your team and put the round together is like, you need to communicate everything that you see, because and not even just what you see, but what you're going to do, right? And what you would like, what you don't see. Like if, say for instance, I'll give you like an example for Valorant. Like say, I mean, this is like such a basic example, but say there was like a Phoenix B main on split and he mollied the B main and he got the orb. And then 20 seconds later, he's threw a flash in middle. That you don't communicate those things, then like, you know, somebody at A might have, because of the things that he saw, he can now make a read and understand like, hey, like they're doing this route, like their specific play because of X or Y. But if everyone just like doesn't calm these things, it's hard to put the round together and realize like that's where, when you see teams have like really good reads on situations, it's a lot of the time just comes down to the fact that their communication is good, so they can paint the picture of the round and kind of know what's happening, right? Where other teams, like, it's not because they're bad, but if their communication is worse, it's harder for them to reliably put the information together and create like an actual solution to the round, if that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I love that, you know, painting the picture, you know, ensuring that you are communicating effectively. And, you know, it's critical. You know, we are playing a team game, you know. You know, I can really result back to when I was previously playing in Pro Mod COD 4, MW2, screaming back in the old cyber game at DMC and OCE. And things weren't really there. Comms weren't there. We were really, you know, a one-man army. It's essentially just like five individuals, you know, happened to be on the same team. And I think that comms really are pivotal for great success.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Now, anxiety is one that I absolutely love to talk about just because it happens with everyone. Everyone undergoes some sort of anxiety, whether it's somatic, you know, more of that activation of nervous system, you know, clammy hands, you know, that's me, keyboards dripping wet, mouse is absolutely in the deep fryer, or that cognitive anxiety, you know, that negative mentality, that poor mindset. How do you control some of these variables, and do they happen to you?
So for me, I just, like, I've always been the kind of person where when I look at, I wouldn't say that this happens all the time. I think there's definitely been instances where my mental's got the better of me, but I try to, like, I look at it, it's like, it's just literally five humans playing a video game, right? Like, it doesn't really, you take away the names on the other team, they're just human beings, right? Like, there's no difference between me and them or them and my teammates. Like, at the end of the day, we're just dudes playing a computer game. And so for me, I never really get anxious, or I never really feel like the pressure of, like, you know, things gonna fail, because I, at the end of the day, I just treat it as like everybody's equal, right? We're all just people playing a game. And so that's the way I look at it to help me kind of focus on, you know, the matter at hand. But I could definitely say that, like, deeper thinking kind of things, like, there's been matches, especially recently on C9, where like the pressure got to the team overall, where like we stopped playing to win and we played to not lose. And I think that's like a really good mentality that can plague a lot of teams. But for me personally, like I don't really get the nerves, because it's just something I've experienced. And it's not something that was like day one, I had no nerves. Like there was definitely, when I was coming up in my first pro matches, like I was definitely nervous and like, I don't want to mess up and like, you know, screw this up. But like, you know, the more experience you get playing at the high level, it just becomes like second nature. You don't even think about, like, the stakes don't mean anything. It's just like another match, you know. Developing it just takes time, right? There's a very few people, like the guys that are naturally like elite are probably the ones that don't have the pressure. And even insanely good players that become like elite tier one players in any sport or any game, like, you know, they're not always at that point, right? I'm sure that a lot of them at some point were nervous and you know, when they were rookies and things like that. It's very rare to see somebody just be instantly insane out of the gate in high-pressure situations.
Yeah, again, I think it's one of those things that you build up tolerance over time. You know, you gradually become exposed to it. And, you know, you become more adapt to it, and becoming more adapt to it allows for more performance, you know, with shows. And that's when you can get to that stage and that apex where you can really start to neglect that anxiety, push it aside, because you're a lot more concentrated on the goal and you have that envisionment of, you know, what needs to get done to ensure peak performance.
Yeah, I also think that comes down to, right, like you said, the more experience you have, but the experience also means that you likely have more solutions to problems, right? Like you have an answer to things. So the more you experience something, the greater chance you're going to have a way of dealing with that in the future, right? So the first time something happens, it might be really hectic, and you might feel the pressure because you don't have an answer. But you know, when you see it again, you see it a third time, fourth time, and so on, it just becomes instantly like easier to identify. And then at that point, it becomes more instinctual to know like what you need to do in those situations, which that takes away some of the nerves because there's less like uncertainty with the situation, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I love that. You know, being able to, I guess, take a step back and have a look, you know, from an external perspective, and be able to understand, you know, we have that kind of past memory bank where we've done these actions, we've been in these scenarios, and we know the outcomes. So I guess we can kind of pick and play different outcomes, scenarios, and rule them out to ultimately, you know, kind of predict performance, essentially. And, you know, one of these ideas that comes up is this whole idea of, you know, reinforcing positive statements. It's used in traditional sports quite a lot. You know, I can tackle, I can kick the score, I can do whatever. Is that one of the things you might do? You know, I can hold this angle, I can hold, you know, this whatever it may be, I can communicate effectively. You know, are they some of the things you employ?
I don't know. I mean, I'm always confident in myself as a competitor. And yeah, I don't know if I don't know if there's any like routine or something that I have in that regard, but it's interesting. I've never really thought about it in that way.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of guys I've spoken with early on in a couple of podcast episodes have said it as well, that they really you know, love those positive self statements, and it's critical. You know, especially at that high-end level when we make a mistake and the smallest mistake can be the biggest impact sometimes. You know, we could have got the kill, we could have got the frag, that was an easy round, we just, you know, we kind of blew it. But then being able to have that positive affirmation to say, okay, let's go into the next round. I've done it before, we've done it before, and because I've done it before, I can do it again in the future. And being able to have that positive mindset is also critical for performance.
Yeah, I would say something interesting about that is I don't think sometimes it necessarily is like, you know, if I miss a kill or someone misses like something that they felt like they should have done, maybe, you know, in their head they're telling themselves like, you know, like it's no big deal, right? Like I know what I'm capable of. It's whatever. Mm-hmm. But I think like people understanding that happened and people like giving you reinforcement, like other people in the team giving reinforcement, I think that's something that's like important. Like if people say like don't worry about it, like if we lose like a really stupid round that we should have won, being able to just shrug it off and people not getting flustered and tilted about the situation and being able to dissolve it, right, and like, you know, actively vocalize it, I think it helps a lot of people. Like not just obviously like you can internalize it and say to yourself, right, and be like, no, it's not a big deal, but I think when other people say it out loud to them, I think it makes people more inclined to believe, right, and keep believing in their abilities, because it shows that someone else also believes in your ability. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I mean, we see it in traditional sports as well. If someone misses a field goal, a pass, a tackle, we have those teammates there available for that positive affirmation and that verbal affirmation as well, whether it be, you know, a pat on the back, you know, hey, it's all right, let's get in the next one. Just being there and providing that support, I think it's very key and pivotal to ensuring future performance in the short term as well. And we see it in esports as well, you know, high fives all around, or the coach in the back saying, okay, let's gear up, let's go for the next one, and, you know, ensuring that we're all positive. Sure. Now, obviously, in regards to flow, so flow is one of those obviously big domains a lot of people tend to think about in regards to optimal performance. When someone enters that flow state, they're really in that, you know, challenge, skill, balance, it feels easy, you know, everything feels absolutely amazing. There's a paradox of control. We're being that sense of being in control without actually feeling it, like we're a robot almost. We're autonomously doing it. And also that transformation of time where things might be speeding up, but actually, whoa, that was that actually a round? Was it actually 4 minutes? Was it actually 2 minutes? That was actually felt like 10 seconds. You know, being in the elite level, have you become adapted to these kind of things?
I would say at this point it's second nature. I definitely have like experienced that, like that flow of time where like you feel like everything is super slow, like even though like the, you know, it's because of the adrenaline, right? Like the adrenaline gets pumping and it feels like, wow, that was like super long, even though it was like a, you know, 10-15 second scenario, and you know, heart racing and you're feeling the the nerves and, you know, the adrenaline's going. But yeah, I mean, at this point for me, it's second nature, but I definitely think like there's definitely been points in games, big matches where I've felt that state of, you know, the flow state for sure.
Yeah, I think a lot of people actively understand it, but don't ultimately recognize when they're actually entering it. And over time, obviously, like you said, it just becomes second nature. They become adapted and they become, you know, possessed by it. Now, you know, obviously, I'm no sports psychologist. I'm more about the sport and exercise science side of things, performance measurement, and really into that coaching kind of side of things. But, you know, going down future into that kind of rehab counseling, into that well-being, you know, I'm really passionate about that kind of psychology domain. And I think it's definitely something that I'm going to definitely look into. And it's definitely an interesting scene.
Yeah.
Now, one thing I haven't talked about with the other guys, which I kind of saved for you just to get on that really elite level kind of understanding and your take on it, is the whole paradox of sleep and its importance of it. Now, obviously, sleep is really stressed into us, you know, to have those good physical capabilities. We need a big, good night's sleep, but not only physical, but also mentally to be able to perform well, to be able to reduce the effects of cognitive fatigue. So what's your take on sleep and, you know, how does it play a role for you?
I mean, I think sleep, I think maintaining balance in your life in general is really important, right? Sleep, nutrition, you know, getting exercise in. Like, I don't think you have to be like a, you know, bodybuilder type and do crazy workouts, but I mean, like for me, I'm not like in the best physical shape, but I try to still, you know, I take my dog out twice a day, walk my dog, try to elliptical, things like this, lifting lightweight, stretch. I think stretching is really important that a lot of gamers don't do, like arm, like, you know, wrist exercises, right? Stretching out your hands, things like that. I try to, I probably could do it a lot more. I also could probably do more vigorous exercise. But for me, I think it's just about maintaining balance, like trying to, you know, not eat like garbage. I don't eat a lot of fast food. Try to, like, I mean, I wouldn't say I make a lot of meals right now, but again, I try to eat like definitely healthier. And I think sleep is super important as well. Like, there's definitely times where I've noticed when I was at my best performances is when I had like a normalized sleep schedule and I wasn't on like the gamer schedule of staying up till 4 a.m. and waking up at like 2. I think it was something I've seen a lot with a lot of my teammates is like we have practice at like 1 p.m. for an example, and my teammates wake up at 12:55 and get on the computer like right before the scrim, and they're just like, the first scrim is completely useless because they're mentally not even awake, right? Like they're they're not communicating, their aim is off, like they're things like this. So I think, you know, all these kind of things like sleep, like you have full control over as a person. And again, just like having self-control and balance is super important because, you know, those are things that you have control over if you want to, right?
For sure.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, man, fully agree with you, and big props to you, if, you know, for having that understanding of an important good night's sleep. You know, I've talked to a lot of gamers before, you know, some that I've coached, and I think that idea of the more you play, the better you'll get, and that grind mentality kind of takes over sometimes. And, you know, you look at traditional sports, and most athletes only spend, you know, upwards of probably 2 hours max on the field, you know, working, breaking down individual skills. Now, of course, you know, because it's more physically enduring, it's, you know, it's more energy draining. There is that more, you know, requirement for them to actually work physically. But I think it'll be really interesting to see where those optimized times are for a practice, because it's really easy, obviously, for us gamers, just cue into a game. You know, we go again, and you know, we just cue and we cue into the next one, the next one, the next one, and before we know it, it's been 8 hours. So I really think it's important, as you said earlier on, to have that standardized, kind of schedule for routine practice. And then that differentiates between, you know, just recreational gaming or play and, having those important set scheduled hours to ensure, next day performance.
Yep. Well, I mean, the main thing is like, you know, unlike playing basketball, it's not, you know, playing Valorant is not physically
demanding. Right? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's like it's definitely mentally exhausting. Like, I definitely after a long practice, I'm definitely mentally drained. But you know, physically, like, it doesn't. I don't feel winded or anything, right? From unlike real sport. So like, the other thing too is like because of that, people grind way like longer, but it's not quality all the time. You know what I mean? Like, quality practice is always going to be more beneficial than the quantity. Like, you can play 10 hours of competitive, right? 10 hours of ranked. And, you know, even though, like, yeah, you will be better than if you didn't play at all, because you're just naturally, you know, working on your mechanics, and you know, you're naturally playing something and doing something. So, like, you're just going to inevitably become better. But, like, how do I even put it? It's like, if playing tier one teams in practice, playing five scrims, you're going to get more value than playing 20 pugs of competitive, because
definitely,
like, the players you're playing are better, like, their decision making, you're learning a lot more in those regards. But, and then because you're not physically drained from playing, you can just kind of go all the time, right?
Yeah, sure. Again, you know, just having that structured set time. And I guess if you queue into a scrim, you know, both parties are equally invested. Whereas if you queue into a ranked with, you know, a five man, you know, you get AFK, you get toxic guys, you know, it's just not the same experience as, you know, a scheduled, you know, set scrim. And I think that's where your best bang for your buck in terms of practice, you know, hours. And if you go into, you know, a structured scrim,
no, 100%.
You know, a couple of days, a couple of times a day, a couple times a week, whatever it may be, there's a lot more lessons to be learned, as you said. Just going into the end now, just starting to turn the engines on for this, for the end. In terms of brand building, you know, I think that a lot of up and coming esports athletes, especially the youth nowadays, they have the physical capabilities. Like, as you said earlier, they can tap, they can hit the one taps. But in terms of marketing themselves and branding themselves, whether they're on Twitter, Twitch, you know, Instagram, whatever it may be, some aren't always as invested into that kind of side of things. So what's your take on, you know, building yourself and marketing yourself, especially for, you know, potential teams looking to sponsor you and, you know, get you involved?
I think it's super important. Like, the thing you have to think about is, like, as a player, career is not going to be, like, as a player, your career is, like, no one knows how long your career will last, right? But if you have a brand and you have, like, you're marketable and you're a personable person, like, that lasts a lot longer than anyone can be as a player, right? And, like, you know, some people are just not, like, I'm not saying, like, everybody has to stream. Like, I think a lot of people think that, like, brand means that you have to be a streamer. And for a lot of players, that is what it is, because they're not, like, in-game leaders, right? They're not cerebral or analytical about, like, the game they're playing. So most of the time, they have to just be, like, their way of growing their brand comes from, you know, what they're good at, which is headshotting, right? So then they build their stream and things like that. But, you know, for other people, like, branding can be whatever, right? Like, you can be, you can go into commentary or and analysis or whatever it might be. But I think brand building is super important, because even if you have a big following and a big brand, that also makes you way more enticing and marketable to organizations as well, right? Like, they want to have big name people, right? Just like in traditional sports, right? Like, you'll see so many times in the NBA, like, terrible players are overpaid, and it's because they have a big following, right? Like, or they had, like, a breakout season, they get the bag, and then they just regress as a player, but, you know, they're locked in the bag and they're getting the they're getting the checks. But
yeah, for sure. And I mean, you know, you see it as well, you know, discoverability is key, especially for up and coming guys. And you know, if someone's super elite and they're not really marketing themselves, you know, maybe not really actively streaming, you know, how are teams going to find them? There's a million guys there out there trying to make it, trying to be the next Ninja, trying to be the next Shroud. But if they aren't out there marketing, showing, you know, how are they going to get there? How are they going to get found?
Funny you say that too, because you hear it so many times. These people that always are like the poor me mentality, where they're like, I'm on a team, like, I'm unlucky and or things like that, and then, like, they just don't stream or don't put themselves out there. And it's like, the only way for people to know who you are is you either have to play in tournaments and prove it, or you have to stream so people can see it, right? Like, that's also where a lot of players that are not that good, they get hyped up, super hyped, because they're like a clip machine on Twitch, right? Like, they just do, like, crazy things on their stream. And so people think, like, people have this illusion of them that they're, like, the best player of all time, right? And so that can also help you in a lot of ways beyond just obviously having the brand. But, you know, perception is a lot in you know, gaming.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty important in every aspect of life, but, you know, That's a big factor that I think people don't really think about, or even if they do think about it, they aren't actively, like, trying to do something about it.
Yeah, man, completely agree with everything you've said. And for those interested, you know, what advice do you have for those guys looking to get from more of a casual perspective into the competitive scene? For those who are trying to maybe get picked up by a team, looking to become more discoverable, actively streaming on Twitch, you know, ultimately looking to get into that competitive nature of gaming.
So I think one of the biggest things is like holding yourself accountable for your mistakes and just being critical of yourself, right? Like not thinking about, you know, what other people are doing. The only thing you can control is yourself. And, you know, obviously you want to work hard and all those things, but you also have to be realistic and like have goals for yourself. And you have to just be realistic with where you are, right? Like, it's okay to not be good right now and realize that, like, hey, I'm not that good. Like, I need to be putting in more work, right, to get better and focusing. Like, there's a lot of people that think that they're way better than they are, and so they don't actually get to where they want to be because their mentality is holding them back, right? And that goes hand in hand with being humble, right? Just realizing that, like, you know, people are where they are for a reason, and it's not on you to, like, you know, feel a certain way. The only thing you control, again, is yourself. So if you're humble and you're you hold yourself accountable for your actions, you're going to make it far because your mentality is enabling you to improve and to grow, right? Like, that's the thing, I think, for people that are aspiring to get pros. I get that question asked a lot on my stream when I was streaming. They ask me all the time, like, you know, oh, I'm in plat 3 or I'm diamond, and like I want to get to radiant, and like, what if for me, like, how can I get better? And, you know, I can't tell them, like, without watching their game, I can't tell them specifics to work on. But the only thing I can say that's like general and applies to everybody is the things I said, you know, previous, like just being humble and, you know, being accountable for yourself and being critical and just, you know, thinking about what you can always do better, and not really worry about anyone else. That's like the most important thing.
Yeah, man, absolutely love it. I definitely agree with it because, you know, as you said, having that accountability means that you are actively engaged with it and you are actively concerned about it. And if you have that accountability, if you are critically thinking, then you're a lot more adapted and you're a lot more likely to be better and succeed. So for those listening and want to get in, you know, find some more of your content, where can we find you on all your socials?
So you can find me on Twitter at @Shinobi_FPS. You can go to twitch.tv/Shinobi. That's my Twitch account. Yeah, those will be the only two socials that I have that are public. Please don't add me on Instagram. I get a lot of follow requests on Instagram, and it's private for a reason. I'm not trying to have a gaming Twitter or a gaming Instagram at this time, but feel free to follow me on Twitter, and I try to answer fan questions as much as I can. So if my DMs are open. So if anyone has questions and they want to DM me, feel free to toss me a message. I try to reply to all my DMs as much as I can. So
no worries, mate. I'll make sure nobody sends that follow request on Insta. Yeah, awesome, exciting stuff. And obviously, just coming off Cloud9, you know, future teams, you know. It's going to be an interesting space, and I'm absolutely keen to see where you head and everything that happens there.
Yeah, I hopefully I'll be able to talk to you about it in the future when things materialize and, you know, they're public. I'd love to come back and chat with you again.
Hell yeah, man. That sounds absolutely awesome. Well, you know, today we had a really big, giant, pretty in-depth insight into your perspective in terms of esports, you know, the core fundamentals of, you know, being an in-game leader and the key characteristics that are fundamental for ensuring key performance within your team, the future of esports, a little bit of sports science thrown in there in terms of, you know, measurement and performance there. And then obviously touching on some of the great insights of, you know, flow and imagery and anxiety and confidence. And it was absolutely amazing. And honestly, it's just absolutely been a privilege on my behalf. And it was absolutely amazing just to have a chat with you and get an insight because, yeah, it just feels surreal, you know, having that, you know, previously watching back some of your games, you know, obviously big Cloud9. It's been an awesome time and it's been absolutely fantastic. So, yeah, it was a real pleasure, mate.
Yeah. Thank you for the words.
No worries, mate. Well deserved. Well, there you have it, folks. This is pretty much the end of Season 2, Episode 2 with Josh Shinobi Epistato. Absolutely amazing episode. Thank you very much for taking the time. Obviously, with scheduling and everything, it was a little bit hard to keep track of, but we managed to get there in the end, and I'm sure it'll be an absolutely amazing episode for all listeners to hear and experience.
Yeah, no worries, man. Thank you for having me. It's great chatting with you.
All righty, for all you guys who have managed to get this far, once again, as per usual, thank you very much for listening. It was absolutely a privilege on my behalf to talk with Josh today. Just absolutely fantastic episode, just because he has those really elite level insights that I was really, you know, wanted to experience and understand a bit more. And now I can, you know, really understand them, and I'm hoping some of you guys can take on board as well. Especially some of you young guys really looking to get into the esports scene, you know, just hold yourself accountable, begin to have that extra, you know, marketability about yourself, and who knows, maybe you'll be joining the next tier one team. But until then, this has been your boy Lachlan, and I will see you in episode 3. And this should go out pretty much on Christmas Day. So for all you guys who have listened or previously listened, I hope you had an amazing Christmas, or I hope you will have a brilliant Christmas. Episode 3 should go out before New Year's. It's going to be an awesome one, and I'll catch you in that one as well. Catch you, guys.